a cancer cluster in Toms River.
Starting in the 1970s and 1980s especially, many people in town, you know, started to realize, hey, a lot of kids in Toms River seem to be getting sick. An unusual number of kids.
That's Dan Fagan. We'll talk with him about his terrific history of what went down at Toms River, New Jersey, after a chemical plant moved in. His book is Toms River, A Story of Science and Salvation. And cancer isn't the only disease kids are getting from environmental toxins. The explosion in rates of autism could be linked.
Whenever you have one in every 55 children in this country adversely affected by a neurological disorder on this scale, we all have a responsibility to start asking some very fundamental and serious questions amongst ourselves.
That's Ed Brown. His new film is Unacceptable Levels. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When the chemical plant Ciba Geigy first opened a plant in Toms River, New Jersey, the townspeople rejoiced. Finally, a chance for some well-paying jobs. What they didn't know was that they'd entered into a Faustian bargain. Good jobs in exchange for their children's health. When they finally found out what was making their kids sick with cancer, they mounted a years-long struggle with the company to clean up the waste and get compensated for their losses. In riveting prose, prize-winning science journalist Dan Fagan takes the reader on an in-depth exploration of how the Toms River Cancer Cluster came to be. Along the way, he explains the science and history of epidemiology, how science becomes a battleground between truth and spin, and he tells the stories of some very courageous parents and children. Dan Fagan is the director of the Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program at NYU. For 15 years, he was the environmental writer at Newsday, where he was twice a principal member of reporting teams that were finalists for the Pulitzer Prize. Fagan's articles on cancer epidemiology won the Science Journalism Award of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the Science in Society Award of the National Association of Science Writers. Dan Fagan, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks. I'm glad to be with you.
You start out in this book, Toms River, A Story of Science and Salvation, with a discussion of the discovery of coal tar. First of all, why did you start there? And then tell us, what is coal tar and why is it so important to this story?
Coal tar, it turns out to be the substance that gave birth to the synthetic chemical industry. It was really the first synthetic hazardous waste. It's a byproduct that you get when you burn coal at very high temperatures. So I thought it was important to start the book that way because industrialization really gave birth to the synthetic chemical industry, and the synthetic chemical industry is really what ultimately was responsible for what happened in Toms River. So, you know, I could have just told the story of Toms River itself, but I thought it was more important to really show the universality of this problem. And the way to do that is to help people really understand its roots and its implications. So I wanted to go way beyond Toms River itself.
And you also talk about the link to cancer in the beginning. In fact, you talk about the beginning of the field of occupational health with Percival Potts. And there's a link there as well. I mean, to creosote, which in many ways I guess you would say is similar or the same thing as coal tar. Is that right?
Yeah. It's a hydrocarbon. I wanted to show, you know, the timeline here, you know, that this is a story about what happened to a specific group of people in one place. But they're also caught in much larger, you know, currents of history and progress, or at least so-called progress. And two of the most important lines that I wanted to trace are the development of the synthetic chemical industry and also the development of public health, the discipline of public health, and specifically two areas of science, toxicology which is the study of hazardous compounds, and epidemiology, which is the study of patterns of disease, because it turns out that both of those disciplines have been really important in helping us understand what makes us sick and why.
Yes, and it's this is a fascinating treatment of just exactly why it becomes such a contentious issue. In fact, you say at one point in the book that science became both a weapon and a target. And I guess before we go on to the specific case of Toms River, say what you mean by that.
Right. Well, it's interesting. It was quite interesting to me, you know, how this thing developed, you know, how both the industry developed and how research into carcinogens developed, because early on, when it was not really clear that synthetic chemicals could cause cancer, you know, some of the best research was really done by industry, by folks working for DuPont and other important chemical producers. But that really began to change starting in the 1930s, when molecule after molecule were identified as carcinogens, typically through animal tests, but also through epidemiological studies that found very high rates of particular kinds of cancer in particular industrial settings, you know, factory workers. So that really changed when suddenly corporations realized that the stakes were very high and that there was a lot of money to be lost if their products were found to be carcinogenic and caught the attention of government regulators. So that's when science really became an area of intense contention. And things changed. And I trace the role of one particular guy, Wilhelm Huper, Bill Huper, who was an absolutely fascinating guy who fought in World War II, actually on the German side, because he grew up in Germany, and then came over to the U.S. and really did some incredibly important early research on environmental carcinogens. Eventually wrote the most important textbook in the field. He wrote in the 1940s, and he had the National Cancer Institute's section on occupational cancer until he was removed from that. And he really personified this transition, because when he was working for DuPont early on, well, first he told DuPont they had a problem with bladder cancer and exposure to synthetic dyes. And DuPont said, no, we don't. And Huper said, yes, you do. And a few years later, DuPont came back to him and said, yep, we do. Please come work for us. And Huper did amazing work in DuPont, both doing traditional interview case series studies with workers, a huge number of whom had bladder cancer. They worked in this particular plant in Deepwater, New Jersey, right across the river, right across the Delaware River from DuPont's headquarters in Wilmington. And also by giving these dye chemicals to dogs, and all the dogs developed bladder tumors. And it was like suddenly a light went on in the minds of these DuPont executives, and they realized, well, this is not information that is in our company's best interest. So they fired Huper and told him that he could not talk about his results, at least most of them. And Huper went on to work closely with Rachel Carson in the development of Silent Spring. But he also had a very rough time with various industries that he tangled with. At one point, he was accused of being a communist. At another point, he was accused of being a fascist. It's really hard to be both a communist and a fascist, but that's what he was accused of. And he eventually came to the conclusion that corporate-funded science simply could not be trusted. And this came from a person who began his career very much in the heart of corporate science, doing what he thought was very good work in toxicology and epidemiology. So that's what I really mean about this transition, Francesca, and that is that early on, before the stakes were so high, the best work was really being done by the people who knew the most about these molecules, which were the people that made them. But that really began to change once these corporations realized that there was huge, massive amounts of money to be made or lost, depending on the results of these health studies.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with prize-winning journalist Dan Fagan about his terrific new book, Tom's River, A Story of Science and Salvation. And so far we've been talking about the science part. We'll get to the salvation later. This story zeroes in on the impact of one particular chemical plant, which was eventually known as Ciba-Geigy, in the community of Toms River, the impact of it on the community of Toms River, where it was located. What did Ciba-Geigy produce there, and why did they choose Toms River to produce it? I mean, they came all the way from Switzerland.
Yeah, they did come all the way from Switzerland, and, you know, that was another reason to incorporate the history, because you know, what I realized is that Ciba-Geigy eventually came to Toms River in 1952 after really having a very hard time with various communities where it was located, where it had done its previous dye and plastics manufacturing. You know, I zero in on two of them, which is Basel, Switzerland, the original community where there was rampant groundwater contamination and also contamination of the Rhine River, and then they moved. They eventually had plants all over the world, and there were lots of pollution issues. But the second one that I zero in on is when they moved to Cincinnati, Ohio, and there their waste fouled the Ohio River. And then finally, they moved in 1952 to Toms River and to locate their dye manufacturing, their American dye manufacturing processes there. And the reason they came to Toms River, well, there were a few reasons. One is that it was a convenient location near the textile plants in North Carolina. But it was also really important to them to have plenty of space and privacy. In previous cities, they had been hemmed in on all sides by communities, which created all kinds of problems. And in Toms River, they didn't have that problem. And that was really important because it turns out that dye manufacturing, which is the first thing that moved to the new Toms River site, generates a tremendous amount of hazardous waste. It's just unbelievable how much hazardous waste it comes from making dyes, especially the anthraquinone dyes that Ciba-Geigy was making at that time. It actually generates much more liquid waste than actual dye, which is crazy when you come to think about it, but it's true. Most of that waste was liquid, although there were also some solid waste. And there could have been some air pollution at that time, except that the waste was so volatile that you wouldn't dare burn it. It would be explosive. Later, there was a huge amount of air pollution from the factory. And what they did is they just took all that liquid and solid waste and they dumped it. Their property was sort of pockmarked with open pits and other dumps. And also they piped their liquid waste, a lot of it, through a series of holding ponds that did one of two things. A lot of the holding ponds had no bottom to them, or the liner was very ineffective. So the liquid waste would just drop right into the sandy soil, just as if you were pouring water on a sponge, and the sponge would absorb it. And then the rest of the liquid waste went right into the Toms River. And the Toms, unlike the Ohio, say, or the Rhine, was really more like a creek than a river, and it was woefully inadequate. It just could not handle so much liquid waste. So sure enough, there are the same things that had happened in Basel and in Cincinnati started to happen in Toms River. Anytime you put something in the ground and then you pump groundwater out of that nearby area, you're going to get contamination, and that happened in this case. The first wells that were contaminated were the factory's own wells. They fouled their own nest first. And then neighborhoods, you know, right over the fence line of the factory that had private wells, many of those wells were contaminated. And then the public well system that supplied, you know, most of the town was right down the river, and the river water would actually seep through the riverbank and then up into the wells. So anything that went into the river would eventually go into the public water system. And that happened in Toms River starting in the 1960s. So it was really definitely foreseeable, predictable process. And Ciba had been through this before. And here it was happening again in Toms River. And it's important to point out, too, that Sibagaygi, the big chemical factory, was hardly the only source of pollution in town. There were other things going on, especially a really terrible, illegal, hazardous waste dump in the back of a chicken farm in the early 1970s. Union Carbide had a chemical plant up in northern New Jersey, and they arranged with a trucker, a very disreputable trucker, to just take thousands of barrels of waste. And he wasn't too specific on with Union Carbide on where he was taking that waste, and Union Carbide didn't seem to want to know. They didn't want to ask too many questions. So this guy dumped all those barrels at a different part of town, and the waste from those barrels eventually contaminated a different set of public wells in the 1980s and 90s. So there were all kinds of things happening in Toms River, and they eventually led to some really tragic consequences.
A cancer cluster among children, which I would like us to talk about more in depth a little bit later. So there first began to have some glimmerings of criticism as a result of the obvious contamination of the water. And I found it very interesting, telling really, on page 58, you talk about the response of the company to the criticism. The general manager of the plant, Sponigal, said, "If the responsible people of this area want a prosperous community with continuing growth, we must realize there will be changes in our natural environment. Very few of us are willing to live like the Indians in spite of our idyllic dreams." I wonder if you could unpack that statement for us.
Yeah, I was shocked by that statement on one level, but I also thought it really did articulate exactly what was happening in Toms River at that time. You know, I didn't really make it clear when you asked me about it initially, but Toms River, you know, in the early 1950s was not a wealthy place at all. It was sort of equidistant from Philadelphia and New York, but far enough that it was really out of their economic orbit. There was some agriculture, a little bit of shore tourism, but there was no Garden State Parkway at that time. There was no easy way to get down to Toms River. And so really, it was a place that was really struggling economically. And when the Swiss came to town, most people in Toms River were thrilled because they thought, well, at last we're going to, you know, this is going to be our route to prosperity. And in one sense it was. Certainly the wages, that those are the best blue-collar wages, you know, anywhere in central New Jersey were being paid at that plant in the 50s and the 1960s. I mean, it was a real route to, you know, mobility. You know, it was a personification of the American dream for these blue-collar workers who had a steady job that paid well. They could even buy a house. They could share in the growth of the town. You know, as long as you didn't think too much about the long-term consequences, it was a good deal for all concerned. And for many years, you know, it wasn't just the company that declined to think about the implications of what it was doing. It was also the workers and many people of the power structure of the town, because everyone was benefiting in the short run from the growth, from all the wages that the company was putting into town.
We're talking with journalist Dan Fagan about his book, Toms River. It's the story of the devastating impact of a chemical plant's operations on the lives and health of a community, and how that community fought back. And yet the price that was paid was pretty high, ultimately. Talk about what happened to the children.
Well, it's always hard to figure out exactly, you know, when a cluster begins, and it's even harder, of course, to figure out, you know, confidently what the cause of that cluster is. But what happened is, starting in the 1970s and 1980s especially, many people in town, you know, started to realize, hey, a lot of kids in Toms River seem to be getting sick, an unusual number of kids. Now, this is not an unusual thing. You know, many people all over the world report what they believe are unusually high rates of cancers and other diseases. And so when it happened in Toms River, the authorities responded predictably. There was a woman named Linda Gillick, who was a really critical person in this whole saga, whose son was diagnosed with neuroblastoma when He was only 3 months old, and it was such a dire situation that the Gillicks actually bought a coffin for him because they didn't want to have to buy a coffin when death came. And the doctors had told Linda and her husband, Rusty, that it was a 50-50 chance at best that Michael would reach his first birthday. Michael surprised everybody, and he's still going strong today. He's in his 30s and is a community activist, very bright guy. But at the time, very few people thought that he had a chance of living beyond his toddlerhood. So Linda noticed that, and she started asking questions, and she asked the county health department and the state health department to look into it, and they said, well, you know, there's no need to do that. Trust us, you know, we're the experts, we can handle this. You're just a typical resident, a housewife, she was a former teacher, you know, leave it to us. And they sort of blew Linda off, and it wasn't just Linda Gillick, it was, you know, many people, even the head of the county health department had some concerns about it and wanted it looked into, but this state of New Jersey really wasn't interested in doing that, at least not interested in doing it very well. What finally changed was when a nurse at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia complained. CHOP, as that hospital is called, is a really superb pediatric hospital, one of the very best in the whole world, one of the most eminent, certainly the most famous. And CHOP gets kids from all over the world to come to this hospital. And Lisa Bornazian, this nurse, worked in the pediatric oncology ward, and she thought it was really strange that so many kids were coming from Toms River, New Jersey. You know, this hospital from, you know, that would get patients from all over the world seemed to get an unusual number of patients from Toms River. And, you know, when you're a nurse, you really bond with these children and families. You see them, you know, and you get to know them in ways that the doctors certainly don't get to know them. You know, you spend those long night shifts with them. And Lisa got so close to some of the families that she would go to funerals. And she went to a funeral in Toms River, and she drove past the Sibigaigi plant. She said, oh, that's the plant that some of the families were telling me about. It really bothered her. And as it happened, she had a sister-in-law who worked for the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. And so she mentioned that at dinner one night to her sister-in-law, and her sister-in-law knew who to talk to within the federal government to try to get an investigation going. And that was a real breakthrough, because when Lisa had earlier talked to the doctors on the ward and said, aren't you concerned that there are so many students from Toms River, the doctors blew her off, just like the state health department had basically blown Linda Gillick off and had told her, you're just a nurse, just keep your head down, do your job, it's just a coincidence. But Lisa didn't think it was a coincidence, just like Linda didn't think it was a coincidence. And thanks to the chain of events that began with Lisa's complaint to her sister-in-law, the state of New Jersey finally did do a cluster study. And lo and behold, they determined that there were indeed a very unusually high number of childhood cancer cases in Toms River. And then, in fact, there was a bullseye pattern, a kind of a dose-response pattern that suggested rates were highest in portions of central Toms River, less high farther out, and lower still farther out from that. So it was like a bullseye, and that's the kind of thing that really concerns epidemiologists when they see that kind of pattern. But even then, Francesca, this did not reach the public, and the state health department tried to keep that quiet. What happened in 1996 is that the story hit the largest newspaper in the state, a big screaming headline about a cancer cluster in Toms River. And that happened in the Newark Star-Ledger. And once that happened, well, then all hell broke loose. And there were, you know, several community meetings attracted more than 1,000 people. People were absolutely freaked out. They thought that information was being hidden from them. And they demanded a full-blown environmental investigation that would seek to understand why there was this cluster. And eventually that investigation was done. It took a long time. It was not completed until the end of 2001. And to everyone's shock, that investigation concluded that there was indeed a statistically significant association between some forms of cancer, specifically leukemia in girls, and exposure to air from the Sibigaigi plant. Later, the Sibigaigi became a huge source of air pollution starting in the 1960s. And the other association that the study found was to water that had been contaminated by that illegal dumping incident involving the thousands of barrels from Union Carbide. So that was a really remarkable thing, and it doesn't happen very much, that the studies are very rarely done, full-blown environmental studies, and when they are done, it's very difficult to draw a strong connection between the high rate of cancer and exposure to a particular environmental exposure. But that happened in this case. And it's hard to say that justice was done, because while the families did, they entered into a negotiation with the companies, a legal negotiation. They eventually won legal settlements, 69 children and their families. It's hard to really say that's justice exactly, because some of those children were dead by then. Many others had lived through many years of agony. And the companies, of course, never admitted liability, because they never do.
And say why. How does that happen, that they don't admit liability? And what are the arguments that the companies throw up against such epidemiological findings of cancer clusters that make it so difficult, so long, to actually win, even in the few cases where people do win?
Yeah. Well, the companies aren't completely wrong here, because epidemiology is never going to give you certainty. It's never going to tell you for sure what caused any particular case of cancer. Epidemiology is instead about likelihood. It's about probability. If it's done right and properly, based on sound statistical principles, it can tell you the likelihood that a particular cluster was associated with a particular environmental exposure or series of environmental exposures. So we can never say for sure. You know, we know that clusters appear in nature all the time. You know, when you see a flock of birds flying through the sky, they're not evenly distributed in the sky. There's some clumping, right? If you were just sort of throwing darts randomly at your garage door and not really aiming, the holes that the darts would make would not be evenly distributed across the garage. They would clump. So the hard part is, we know that, since we know that things can cluster totally randomly due to chance for no particular reason, the hard part is figuring out which clusters have a specific cause and which clusters are just due to random chance. And so it turns out it's very difficult to do that. You know, we have all kinds of statistical tests that we apply to give us confidence that something is either likely to be a random cluster or that something is likely to be a so-called true cluster with an actual cause. But because there will always be that uncertainty, it's very easy for a skeptic to attack any cluster study and say, well, you can't say for sure that that's a cluster. And it's true, you can never know for sure. But what we can say is what the probability is that a cluster had a specific cause. And in this case, the evidence was really quite strong that this was a true cluster in Toms River, and that it did, and that at least some of those excess cases were related to particular environmental exposures. But that doesn't remove the controversy. You know, no matter what the state of the evidence is, it's easy to attack the results. And of course, that's what happened in this case, and it's why the companies did not admit liability. I mean, you know, the families could have hung on and pushed for a trial, but that would have taken many, many years, and the results would be uncertain. You know, ultimately, they had been through a lot already, and they decided they didn't want to take that chance. They decided they would take the sure thing, which was the settlement. But no one was really enthusiastic about that, believe me, because many of them felt like the money wasn't enough. And they wanted an apology. They wanted some kind of admission. And they did not get that.
So given that it's so difficult to make the scientific case watertight about these chemicals, the companies come back and they say, well, there's doubt about this, so we're going to keep on using these chemicals or we're going to keep on dumping these chemicals. They can't possibly have the impact that, you know, people are claiming that they have. It ain't us. What do you think about that argument?
Well, I think what we have to do is rethink our regulatory system and not let these molecules be innocent until proven guilty. The burden of proof ought to be on the person who introduces the molecule into the environment, because we know that there are real limitations to what epidemiology and toxicology can tell us. And it is very difficult, as you said, to make an airtight case. It really can't be done because there's so much uncertainty. So the real question is, what do we do in the absence of definitive evidence? I think what we need is a risk-based system that makes intelligent decisions even in the absence of definitive evidence, that says, okay, here's the state of the evidence on this compound. There are some things here that are problematic, so perhaps we shouldn't introduce this compound, or perhaps we should restrict this compound. We got to get away from this innocent until proven guilty and instead move to the precautionary principle, which says that in the absence of definitive evidence, the cautious thing to do is to restrict a potentially problematic compound. And Europe is actually moving in that direction. The REACH program is not perfect, but it's pretty good. So I'm not completely pessimistic about this. I do think that in the long run, regulatory agencies are going to move to systems that, instead of setting up what are essentially criminal trials of these products with a very high burden of proof, they're instead having a kind of a rational discussion about this and say, okay, what are the costs? What are the benefits? Do the costs exceed the benefits? What's the state of the evidence? What's the weight of the evidence, even if the evidence isn't definitive? What are the alternatives that are out there for these particular products? If there's a safer alternative, let's move toward it. I think that is going to happen. I mean, the real barrier in the United States is less from the regulatory agencies, although there is resistance there, but it's primarily political. It's really from the elected officials. I mean, we're stuck in this country, you know, with a regulatory system that was devised mostly in the 1970s and 1980s. We don't really pass environmental legislation anymore. We're in limbo. And as a result, we're relying on laws that are very out of date. And we're going to have to break that political impasse at some point to make progress here. You know, when people always ask me what's the most important thing I can do to protect my family and advance public health, I say, in my opinion, the most important thing you can do is support campaign finance reform, you know, that opens up the political process and reduces the influence of special interests. Because really, that's the root of our problems. And if we can open up the political system, we can devise much more sensible regulations that are not necessarily more expensive. In some cases, they're going to be less expensive, but they're certainly going to do a much better job of protecting public health, and that's what we need to do.
And they will be, of course, much less expensive to those who are impacted by the operations of the companies.
Absolutely.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion about a fascinating book. The book is Tom's River, A Story of Science and Salvation. Dan Fagan, thanks so much for talking with us.
It was nice to be with you.
You can read an excerpt from Dan Fagan's book, Tom's River, by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk with concerned father and filmmaker Ed Brown about unacceptable levels of toxic pollutants. Stay tuned. After the break.
There was a knock one morning. A man was standing at my door. He said, "Hello, I'm from Halliburton. Have you heard of us before? We'd like to lease your backyard to drill for natural gas. It's called hydraulic fracturing and is the very pass for a clean energy future above the Marcellus Stone. Plus, we'll give you lots of money and a new mobile phone." I said, "You are a corporate crook. I don't believe the things you tell, and you can drive right off my property and then go straight to hell. No fracking way. No fracking way. trust corporate salesmen, whatever they may say. No fracking way, no fracking way, no fracking way. As if the situation weren't sufficiently unattractive, we tested the water and found it was radioactive. Now my property is worthless and there's a tumor in my brain. Half of my neighbors are sick, the rest are just in pain. Maybe I should take the money, move off to live somewhere, but all the places I look at, they're fracking there. Our choices now are simple. Lose that which we hold dear, or communicate the message in a way that's unstoppably clear. No fracking way.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When Ed Brown's wife went through a miscarriage before giving birth to her first child, and then another before giving birth to her second, the couple began to wonder if it was something in their environment that was making it hard for them to bring a pregnancy to term. When Brown began researching his environment, he began to learn that his children, like everyone's, are exposed to thousands of man-made chemicals interacting with each other and putting them and us at risk. From phthalates and rubber duckies to pesticides in our food, from the toxic sludge sprayed on crops to the neurotoxins in our water and spewed into our air, chemical exposures are causing rates of cancer, birth defects, and neurological disorders like autism to skyrocket. Ed Brown put what he discovered into his prize-winning film, Unacceptable Levels. Like Gasland and Food, Inc., it combines personal story with expert interviews to put the pieces of puzzle together of environmental toxins and what we can do about them.
We have 80,000.
80,000.
80,000 chemicals in commerce.
Companies are free to put a chemical on the market with zero information about its health or safety properties.
You look at some of the things that are on store shelves today and you can't believe it.
We have products on the market and nobody knows if they're safe or not, and nobody's testing it because they don't have to.
I don't want to take the chance of buying something that could be really bad for my family.
Well, that's the gang. Chances are, you bought them already.
Ed Brown, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
So in this film, this wonderful film, Unacceptable Levels, you framed it as a very personal story. And I really love how you brought your concern about your young children into the film. In fact, that was the inspiration for you doing the film. Is that right?
That's a fact. I mean, they're an inspiration for why I do almost everything that I do, along with my wife. I thought that there was one thing that I wanted to demonstrate to audiences across the world is that this is such a personal story for all of us. And as parents, as mothers, daughters, fathers, sons, you know, brothers and sisters, and all across the board, you know, we have a responsibility to one another. And for myself, you know, it always comes back to them for what, you know, their health is paramount to everything that I'm striving to do. I mean, that is my job, is to keep them alive. So this is one of the most important things that I could deal with them. And, you know, we're trying to work very hard to prevent something like disease from happening as best we can. You know, that way, you know, they can learn from our example. And hopefully pass that along to their own children as well.
So how did it begin to dawn on you that, you know, your children might be at risk?
You know, I was drinking a glass of water at a restaurant that I was working in, and the water itself tasted a lot like chlorine. And I know that they had to put that in there to treat it, but I was thinking about it one day that we're supposed to drink one glass of water, you know, through the course of a day, but eight glasses total throughout the course of one day, I should say. You know, to me, that was anybody really considering what eight glasses of chlorinated water might actually do to me? And then my wife, she had gotten pregnant, and then she had a very early miscarriage, and that was hard to go through. But then we actually had our son a year later, and his name's Braden, and he's 5 years old now. And then a year after he was born, we tried again and then had a second miscarriage. And it was at this juncture, and it was critical for me, that I started putting some some things together. I was sort of, you know, connecting the dots, so to speak, and that's when I started to realize that there is a problem here. There could be a problem for all of us, but I started doing a lot of research and understanding that a lot of the products that we were buying and using and consuming, many of those have very dangerous chemicals in them, and I thought that this was a kind of a bizarre scenario because I thought we would be kept, you know, safe from this kind of harm, and of course we're not.
And in fact, there's some pretty shocking statistics. I mean, I think your film is broad. It goes into a lot of the different kinds of chemicals that we're exposed to. And that's something that I think a lot of people kind of know vaguely, but not in particular. I was surprised to hear that cancer is the leading cause of deaths in children, the leading disease cause of deaths in children. Is that right?
That is correct. Yeah, it's, you know, that's the type of statistic that nobody wants to hear, but the number one leading cause of death in children from 18 and younger is from cancer. Yeah, and one in every 330 will be affected. And, you know, that's a troubling statistic. There's no question about it. And autism is just yet another one of those. It's not just troubling. It's symptomatic of something that we must be doing wrong.
Autism, you mentioned, it's gone from 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 110. I mean, I'm not very good at math, but is that something like 100 times more?
Worse. Yes, that's correct. And, you know, even since the film had been completed, new statistics are even out that show it's 1 in every 55 now. And, you know, that whenever you have 1 in every 55 children in this country adversely affected by a neurological disorder on this scale, we all have a responsibility to start asking some very fundamental and serious questions amongst ourselves. And I think we are. We're getting to the point where we're trying to pinpoint some real reasons for this and get a foundation for it. But, you know, time is of the essence for all of us, and we have to appreciate that fact whenever we're considering what we're doing with our bodies every single moment of every single day.
So, what is the evidence that links cancer and autism in children to exposures to toxic chemicals?
Well, that's a tough thing to determine, because what we have to understand when we sit back and say what chemicals are causing these and what chemicals, what's the dosage? I mean, how much are kids being affected by? How much are we being affected by? The term ubiquitous means that the court system and everybody understands that we are living in a world of carcinogens. So to pinpoint one is impossible. So they know that we're living in a world of carcinogens. They know that it's a problem in the courts, in our corporations, and our government. They all know that it's a problem. But whenever we sit back as a collective unit and sit back and say, well, you know, I got sick and I think it's because of this, then you have to take it to our system of law and prove that this is this particular chemical. That makes it very difficult because we're exposed to our low-dose exposures every moment of every day doesn't allow us to have that period of time. There's a latency period. So whenever I have been exposed to a particular chemical, even at a low dosage, you know, then there's the latency period. There's a period of time that takes place that I have, or a child or something like that has been affected, so you got a timeline there. You're going to have to try to prove that. And for all of us, that's nearly impossible to do that. Now, not in every case. I mean, there are, you know, organophosphates that are a known class of pesticides that have been proven to cause autism. And then there's also, you know, our Superfund sites, demonstrated by Dr. Alan Green in the film, you know, our government Superfund sites and people living around these Superfund sites, which are, you know, very old business that had left the area and you know, in the groundwater or the ground soil or the air has been contaminated in ways that people can be affected. So getting direct evidence and direct 100% irrefutable proof is a very difficult part of this process. And that's why whenever I'm explaining this film, whenever I talk to audiences, I say, you know, there's no way you're going to be able to say it was this chemical and it's in this percentage and it's over this period of time, because only unless you're doing high-dose exposures can you really get that kind of quantifiable evidence to present in a courtroom.
And kids are especially at risk. children are, their cells divide extremely rapidly, and they're being exposed through the things that we give them. You quote Rick Smith, and he's in the film. He's the author of Slow Death by Rubber Duck. I love that title. He says that synthetic materials like carpets that kids are crawling around on to their toys are very important sources of exposure to cocktails of toxic chemicals. Talk about this issue of cocktails and the synergistic effects between them.
You know, whenever our kids are playing, their bodies are developing rather rapidly. And whenever they're playing, usually, especially, you know, in the first year of life, they're crawling around on the floor. Most of the things that they're playing with are going to go into their mouth. And so whenever you have different materials or different products made with very different materials, that means that this stuff is going to get mainlined into the body, either through their skin or through their, you know, any other part of their body, their mouth or their respiratory system. So these chemicals, you know, even if you knew what one of them did, nobody studies what they do in tandem. You know, you have phthalates, you have BPA, you have pesticides, and you have a long laundry list of other chemicals that kids are going to be exposed to every single day unless you're really, really careful. So whenever the people that are ahead of these NGOs or these scientists, when they sit back and it's too difficult for them to even truly know what's going on inside of our body. So when you have one chemical and two chemicals, then you have 160 or up to 250 or maybe even 500 chemicals that these kids are going to be surrounded by every single day, that creates a cocktail kind of effect inside of their body. So that's when, you know, just like a bartender mixing drinks, you know, they're trying to put things together in different levels and stuff like that to try to make the right mixture. And that's exactly what is happening to our children. This cocktail is going to be put inside of their bodies. And dependent on if your family is going to eliminate the particular chemical or a particular product that might be questionable, they're going to keep getting exposed to it every single day. So that you know, over the course of maybe 5 or 10 years, it's really difficult to know what that is going to do to somebody.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Ed Brown about his film Unacceptable Levels. He says that our bodies are being used basically as dumping grounds for waste products of industrial processes, like toxic sludge. I asked him to explain.
Toxic sludge is a waste byproduct from our water system and sewage system in the United States. So whenever we have something we flush down the toilet or it goes down our sinks into our wastewater treatment facilities, all this stuff is collected, and our sewage system works that way too. We want to divert sewage from going into our water facilities. Sure, everybody wants to do that, right? But what do you do with this stuff after it's collected? So everything that goes into our wastewater treatment facilities and into our sewage facilities, I mean, this stuff is collected, and what do you do with it? It's too toxic to incinerate. You can't dump it into the oceans. You can't just bury it underground. So what do they decide to do with it? They decide to use it in our farming industry. So 70% of our farmland is fertilized by our waste byproducts from our wastewater treatment and sewage facilities. So what does that mean? Well, all of these, you know, facilities have tons of different bad microbes and also heavy metals and very toxic materials along with pharmaceutical drugs and stuff like that. They're all going into this, and then it's just going to be spread out upon our farmland, and that's what we're growing crops with. And to me, that was one of the more astounding aspects of the film and what I had learned, because toxic sludge is, they renamed it biosolids to give it, it sounds a lot better than toxic sludge. Nobody wants to put toxic sludge on their ground, so biosolids makes me feel a lot better, even though it's the exact same product, and that's exactly what we've done.
You know, I think most Americans probably presume that the government is taking care of us, or at least they probably presume that most chemicals are safe, that they've had to go through some kind of process whereby, you know, they're proven that they're not going to hurt us before they're being used. Talk about TSCA, which is the law that the Toxic Substances Control Act that was supposed to do this. It was put out in 1976, and now there's a move to update it.
That's right. So in 1976, the Toxic Substances Control Act, the federal government and everybody realized that we were starting to get a massive inventory of chemicals and they were starting to become problematic. We needed to know a lot more about it. Many of those were grandfathered in despite whatever toxicity they may have. So they were brought into and allowed to continue operating as they had been. Any new chemical that was going to be brought onto market was going to have to go through this procedure. And the procedure, unfortunately, wound up stifling people whenever they were setting up their safety committee. So for a chemical to be brought onto the market, they had to prove a number of different things, that it was safe, non-toxic, and it was going to be, you know, used widely throughout our system of commerce. And so what happened was that the chemical companies got smart. They said, well, if you want the safety data and that's what you need to put a chemical onto the market, then we're just going to shut down our safety data regimen. And they shut down their whole departments to prevent even any data from being available. So that way they could circumvent the entire system. And that way Tosca failed, you know, in a big way, even though it was set up with all the best intentions. And I think they did a fairly good job of trying to implement it. But they even tried to regulate out asbestos back in the 80s. They were sued. It was thrown out of court. And this is a chemical or a product that we all know causes massive amount of health problems, and yet it was still – and it's still used today as well, but and it hasn't been banned. So knowing that the federal government – I assumed the same thing. I thought for sure that, you know, chemicals were all going to be proven safe, and that it wouldn't be possible for me to buy anything unless it was safe. That couldn't be further from the truth. And we're all, unfortunately, in that same boat and in that same scenario. We're all feeling like somebody's protecting us, somebody has oversight, and somebody's going to ensure the safety of these products before I can possibly buy something. But that, unfortunately, again, could not be further from the truth.
You actually say that only 5 out of the total universe of 83,000 existing chemicals have been regulated. Talk about this new legislation. Frank Lautenberg, who recently passed away, he introduced an act, a Safer Chemicals Act, and then some things have happened to it. Talk about the current status of legislation around chemicals.
Well, Frank Lautenberg certainly was the champion of this cause. He saw that this was a massive problem, and there's nobody else in our federal government that had seen this as priority number one. I say that because we live in a society of chemicals. Our entire system of government operates that way. Our entire system of commerce works around chemicals. We are chemical addicts, okay? We have to understand that. And I think that that's something he had clearly understood as well. So what he had tried to do on two different failed attempts over the course of his while he was in office, he tried to get legislation even spoken about, and he failed. But then last year he had a breakthrough with the Safe Chemicals Act, and it made it out of committee, and it looked like it had a really good shot at making a difference and actually making a big change in the way we were doing things. But it only had Democratic support, and they needed something that had bipartisan support. So There was a senator from Louisiana, his name is Vitter, who actually proposed his own legislation, and it only had partisan support on the Republican side. So what they decided to do is create a compromise and call it the Chemical Safety Improvement Act. And that has, and at this point, we really don't have any idea what's going to happen through it. We don't know what's going to happen from it. We don't even know if it's going to pass or what changes are going to be added to it before a vote takes place, if a vote takes place. So we're at a point where Frank Lautenberg had unfortunately passed away while still trying to fight this fight. And it's very, very difficult at this juncture right now to know what's going to happen with chemicals. But I will say this much, just from my own vantage point, whatever decision we make, it better be a longstanding one, and more worthwhile than what we are operating with right now.
So What do you think people who are concerned about this, and I would assume that's going to be all of us.
Yeah, well, I'd hope so, right?
Yeah. What should we be doing right now to improve this situation?
People have to take matters into their own hands. We don't know what the federal government is going to do. We can hope for the best. We can hope that they're going to make long-lasting changes for people who may not be as educated on this issue and may not even be as inclined to. They still need to have their health protected, even if you don't know everything about this and even if you don't care about it. That's just me as a person saying, you know what, even for the uneducated, they still need to have some level of protection, right? And so that it only makes sense to me. But you know, we all have a stake in our own health. So my body is my investment. It is my biggest investment. It's not my TV, it's not my house, and it's not my car. My biggest investment is my body, because if this thing goes, it doesn't matter what else I had to put money into or time into. None of those things matter anymore, because if I go down, then everything else goes down with it, right? So for me, whenever I talk to audiences, whatever the federal government's going to do, they're going to do. But you have to take action immediately, and that can start right now. You have to pick something that you might feel like, just one thing, you have to have a starting point. And that's going to be the catalyst for the rest of your life. So if you pick one thing, whether it's water or pesticides, whatever it is, you have to start asking questions about it, start learning something, start digging for some information, and start making changes. And you can make those immediately. Thankfully, there's a lot of great companies that already exist without any kind of government legislation. A lot of great companies are already doing the right thing, whether it's organic food or water filtration or there's a number of other things across the board. What we have to do as people is say, I'm going to make changes. I'm going to start right here. Whatever it is, whatever is most important to you, I'm going to start making changes. And that way our consumer pressure can force change without any kind of legislation, without any kind of regulation. And I'm not saying we don't need that as well, because there are certain instances where there's no question things have to be done, action has to be taken. I would never, ever argue otherwise. I'm just saying, like, for you and me and anyone else that's listening to this, you have to sit back and say, oh, you know what, I'm gonna look into this food thing. I'm a little bit curious about this food thing. Or, you know what, I am curious about sunscreen or personal care products. Or, you know what, I don't want to eat food that's grown eat a cow or drink milk from a cow in grain that's grown with toxic sludge or biosolids. To me, those are things that are fundamentally easy for us to know, and then we can learn more about it, and then we can tell our friends about it, and we can teach our kids about it as well, and then hopefully the world becomes a better place.
And where can people see your film, Unacceptable Levels, Ed Brown?
Right now, you can go to unacceptablelevels.com. You can see we're in limited theatrical release right now, so we're going to be in select cities for a little while. After that, we're going to expand to a more national distribution, a traditional distribution model. So we'll be in a lot more theaters and a lot more areas. That's going to be starting in late August and early September. And then we're going to be going to a new distribution model where you're going to be able to see things online and also go, of course, through iTunes and whatnot. But up until late August, we're going to be in select theaters.
Ed Brown, your film is Unacceptable Levels. It's a terrific film. It's fascinating, and it's also emotionally compelling as well. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Francesca, I couldn't thank you enough. Thank you so much.
Unacceptable Levels has won numerous awards. Go to writersvoice.net to see the trailer and find out where the film is playing. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.